The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
I'm Mo Rocca, and I've got a brand new podcast. It's all about the people who have long fascinated me. The one thing they've got in common? They're all dead. The name of my brand new podcast? Mobituaries. From the 20th century's greatest entertainer.
He was everything. I mean, he could play any instrument. He could dance like a maniac.
To the founding father, who just doesn't seem to get much respect.
This guy did everything wrong. So there's no statue, there's no signature on the Declaration of Independence.
You'll learn new things about people you thought you knew.
Were you aware that the day of your inauguration, Audrey Hepburn died?
No.
You'll learn about people who aren't real.
They did not have room in the writing for the older brother because the Fonz became the older brother.
So join me this premiere season of Mobituaries.
From the Capital One Bank studios in Washington, this is the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
Democrats continue to investigate the president while Republicans protest.
This is nothing but political theater.
The attorney general goes to Capitol Hill next week.
He will face a firing squad of questions about the special counsel investigation.
And what to make of Joe Biden.
And I get it. I get it.
This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. I'm Bill Rakoff here in Washington, and we're joined by Face the Nation moderator and senior foreign affairs correspondent Margaret Brennan. Margaret, let's talk about foreign affairs with our neighbors to the south to start with. The president this week seemed to back way off the threat of closing down the southern border. He hasn't completely taken it off the table, but he's moved it back by, a year or so.
That's right. The president has issued this severe, extreme threat of shutting down the border, which so many of his Republican allies, particularly those in states like Texas, Ted Cruz, John Cornyn said, wait a second, this is a terrible idea because of the hit to the economy that would happen if you shut down these ports. The president seemed to not totally walk away, but backtrack a little bit, saying that now he's giving a 1-year notice to Mexico and that at the end of the 1 year, he may put tariffs on them, specifically on autos, if this problem isn't resolved regarding what he says is their lack of follow through on policing the border. Remember, the majority of migrants who are coming across illegally are not Mexican. They're from Central America. But the president is arguing that Mexico needs to prevent their crossing in their first place.
When I think about the president putting his foot down on something, I remember the government shutdown, and even Republicans were pushing back against him on that. But still, he held firm because he wanted that border money. But here he seems to have backed off. And it's not just congressional voices. He must have been hearing from people in the business community about the threats to commerce and that sort of thing.
No doubt. The last time this border was shut down was in the wake of 9/11. This is something you do in an extreme situation when there are no alternatives and for very specific reasons. There is so much cross-border trade. Whether the president likes the idea of globalization or not, it exists. And it would really devastate Texas's economy. But keep in mind, it's just a stance. There is no pending legislation to enforce any of what he's talking about. He's pulled back from this idea of shutting down the border. And then the wall is in this, you know, partial form at this point. Even with the emergency funds the president is pulling together. And keep in mind, we just finished the month of March where you saw a record number of migrants. 60% of the 100,000 that crossed were families. This humanitarian crisis, which is very real and Democrats would agree with, still isn't being treated in terms of congressional funding to help these specific kinds of migrants, women and children.
And, you know, the way he characterizes Mexico as having sort of jumped to his call to put people back across the border. If you hear Mexican officials tell it, it's a little bit of a different story. And the fact that the Mexican president says, you know, we don't respond to threats. What's been the reaction from Mexico to all this?
It's been surprisingly restrained so far. There is still a new president who's getting his feet wet there. He's called AMLO, A-M-L-O is the nickname for him. López Obrador is his name. And really, so far, the president's relationship with the new Mexican president is much better than the prior one. Peña Nieto really set himself at loggerheads with the president, pushing back at every insult. AMLO, the new president, has kind of been restrained. He's very populist. He's someone who's seen as perhaps Trumpian in a lot of his own tactics. So a lot of the agreement has gone quietly under the radar in terms of Mexico agreeing to hold migrants for processing in the U.S., but on their side of the border. These aren't deportations, so to speak. In other words, people aren't being sent back home. These are these diplomatic compromise deals the U.S. and Mexico have been able to continue to broker through Homeland Security, through the State Department. So there is still a lot of coordination between the two governments, even though the president uses that country on the campaign trail very much as a kind of a punching bag.
Let's switch gears and talk a little bit about the Democrats in the House who have promised to hold the administration to the fire. They are doing that. The latest call is to go after the president's taxes. Democrats say they have it within statute to go and make that request of the IRS and the Treasury Department. The White House says, why aren't you governing and why are you still looking at these things?
Right. This is, you know, the Mueller report may be sort of partially digested, but that's not even half of what we are bracing ourselves for with the smattering of different investigations from various different committees, whether it's financial committees or whether it's judiciary, other places within the Democratic-controlled Congress that are continuing to probe the president's finances. And on this front, it's an interesting sort of workaround. The president has refused to turn over his tax releases, as though in the past, prior presidents have all done so in terms of disclosure. This workaround would go to the IRS to get the paperwork rather than from the president himself. It's not something he wants disclosed. A lot of questions as to why that might be. But this is something it's kind of we're in wait and see mode. There were other issues as well. We're going to have the House Judiciary Chairman on the show this Sunday, and he has already been authorized to issue a subpoena should he need to do so to force the release of the full Mueller report.
A lot of people were very critical of Nadler for doing that, saying Barr has agreed to come, and he has agreed not just come, but to release the report probably April 15th or earlier. He will be on the Hill for other reasons next week. But Republicans say he's promising to be there. He's promising to give you everything you want. Why are we going through the subpoena thing?
That's right. And Jerry Nadler, the chairman of that committee, has said, well, I'll give him time. He's also giving himself sort of a political out to step back a little bit. But the threat is still overhanging us there. And it's really to say we won't accept overloaded redactions from whatever you do make public. If all sorts of pages are blacked out, we want the ability to know why and what those bits of information are. Of course, the precedent, and legal scholars would argue this, is about protecting some of this information, particularly if it came through grand jury subpoena, that it needs to remain confidential. The Democrats are implying here that that standard may actually be politically loaded in this case and picking and choosing what's helping the president or not. So there's some insult or mud being thrown at the attorney general.
Jerry Nadler, the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, will be a guest on Face the Nation this Sunday morning with Margaret Brennan, a moderator and senior CBS Foreign Affairs correspondent. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
It's a good time for a reminder that you can follow us on Twitter. We have headlines at CBS News Radio, and you can follow me at Bill Rakoff. And you can find this program wherever you go for your favorite podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, and Stitcher. Still to come on the program, more on the Mueller Report with CBS's Paula Reed, and we will take a deep dive into the debate over the Electoral College and its impact on presidential campaign outcomes. Thanks for joining us. This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
I'm Bill Rakoff, in for Steve Dorsey this week, and joining us from the White House is CBS News Justice Correspondent Paula Reed. We're talking about the release of the Mueller report. A lot of politics this week going on about that. We'll get to that in just a second. But interesting filing from former presidential attorney Michael Cohen this week, saying he's got a whole lot of extra information he has to give to congressional authorities. And forgive me if there's some skepticism by some people, but some are wondering about the timing of this a month before he's supposed to report to prison.
That's right. With just 30 days to go before he reports to prison, Michael Cohen sent a letter to lawmakers letting them know that he has accessed a hard drive that apparently contains about 14 million files. And he says he's willing to help them go through them. He's only gone through about 1% of them so far. It includes images, voicemails, possibly other recordings. But he says, look, I'm going to prison, and if you want my help with this, perhaps we can get my sentence delayed or reduced. Now, I don't think federal prosecutors are going to go with this, no matter what lawmakers say, because they have criticized Cohen's cooperation as being incomplete.
The Mueller report, as we mentioned, is getting a lot of attention because of the action on the Hill this week. House Judiciary authorized Chairman Jerry Nadler to be able to subpoena the Attorney General for the report itself and any other surrounding evidence and that sort of thing. Republicans mad about that, saying, look, the man's agreed to turn over the report. The man's agreed to come before Congress. Why are we going through this dog and pony show? Paula, why did they go through this dog and pony show?
Well, Democrats have renewed their focus on the Russia investigation. This week, you've seen them sort of escalate their overall investigations into all things Trump. As you said, they were trying to subpoena the full Mueller report. There is a belief that there could be politically damaging information in there. While the special counsel found no evidence of collusion, there was this open question on obstruction of justice. And now, based on anonymous reports from several news outlets, Democratic leaders are seizing on this idea that perhaps the attorney general withheld some information that could be damaging to the president, and they want to get it. But the fact is, the attorney general, he's been working on a redacted version of the report. He says he'll release that in mid-April. And at this point, no judge is going to seriously consider a subpoena for this report until at least the attorney general has had a chance to release that redacted version.
And Barr is going to be on Capitol Hill next week, not necessarily about the Mueller report for budget reasons, but it's a sure bet that he's going to face some questions anyway, yes?
Absolutely. And a lot of folks maybe were a little surprised that they didn't try to reschedule this. Lawmakers may not be able to get as much out of him on the Mueller probe because they don't yet have, and they're unlikely to have, the redacted report. Now, he's only been on the job for a few weeks now, so he's spending a lot of his time preparing for this hearing, not necessarily working on that redacted report. I absolutely expect he will face a firing squad of questions about the special counsel investigation as part of this overall effort by Democrats to renew focus and really double down on their efforts on the Russia investigation. But it's unclear how much he's actually going to be able to share with lawmakers before he releases this redacted report.
CBS's Paula Reed. This is the Weekend Roundup. The debate has intensified in recent years over the Electoral College, in which delegates elected by their states cast the deciding votes for president. In the wake of the 2016 election, where Hillary Clinton won the popular vote but lost to Donald Trump, who won the electoral vote, many Democrats are pushing to eliminate the Electoral College. Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, running for president, is one of them.
We can have national voting, and that means get rid of the Electoral College and
Steve Scott is one of the anchors at our great CBS affiliate, WCBS in New York. He explores the pros and cons of the Electoral College with former Reagan White House counsel Peter J. Wallison, now with the American Enterprise Institute.
Mr. Wallison, we thank you for joining us, and we'll start with this. What is the best argument for keeping the Electoral College system?
I think actually the best argument is that it creates legitimacy that no other system can create. Let's think about it in terms of, say, Bill Clinton's elections. He never did win a majority of the popular vote. He always had 48-47% of the vote. But he won enough electoral votes so that there was never any question about whether he was the president. And the legitimacy of the president is very, very important. That, of course, is one of the issues that we've been talking about now for 2 years because of the challenges to President Trump. But we can't dismiss the question of legitimacy. If the American people believe that the president was legitimately elected, and he is when he gets 270 electoral votes or more, then he is seen by the American people as the president. And that's vitally important. Another advantage, I think, of the Electoral College is that it creates, in effect, our two-party system. Because it is necessary for a person who is running to assemble 270 electoral votes. That requires that we have a two-party system, because only a two-party system can produce one candidate who gets at least 270 electoral votes.
How would you counter those who say, listen, the candidate with the most votes in the country should be elected president, whether a majority or a plurality? If I get 10 more votes than you, I win.
Well, the only way to deal with that question is to think about what would happen if we didn't have the Electoral College, if we just had the candidate who receives the most popular votes become president. What would happen in a case like that is that we wouldn't have a two-party system, because any party could then elect a president with much less than even something close to a majority, with much less than, say, 47-48% of the vote.
The Electoral College was established in 1788. Could it, if nothing else, be spruced up a bit, changed a little, maybe allow a proportional distribution of votes rather than winner-take-all in the states?
Yes, it could. But again, the same problem would probably arise as occurs in a case where you have seven or eight or nine parties running with special issues. We do not have a parliamentary kind of system where we can put together several parties into some kind of majority. We have a system where we have to elect a president with who is acting alone and is elected, hopefully, in a system that allows most of the American people to believe that he has been or she has been constitutionally and democratically elected. And that's what the electoral system does.
Former Reagan White House counsel Peter J. Wallison with WCBS anchor Steve Scott. Hear the entire conversation at WCBS880.radio.com. Still to come, does Joe Biden really get it? This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
Every Sunday, Face the Nation brings you in-depth interviews with the biggest names in Washington.
Kellyanne Conway, Nancy Pelosi, Lindsey Graham, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
You'll never miss an episode with the weekly podcast from CBS News Radio. Tune in to hear moderator Margaret Brennan and the country's top policymakers discuss today's toughest issues.
What is going on? Is this political conspiracy or is this just incompetence?
The Face the Nation podcast. Subscribe today on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Stitcher. From the Capital One Bank Studios in Washington, this is the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
I'm Bill Rakoff. Former Vice President Joe Biden this week issued a video claiming that he gets it when it comes to people's personal space, and he vowed not to put himself into the position of offending women with personal contact. More with CBS's Ed O'Keefe.
Social norms have begun to change. They've shifted, and the boundaries of protecting personal space have been reset. And I get it. I get it.
Former Vice President Joe Biden acknowledged that he has caused discomfort for some, but he didn't apologize to his accusers and defended his personal interactions.
Scores, if not hundreds of people have come up to me and reached out for solace and comfort, something, anything that may help them get through the tragedy they're going through. And so it's just who I am.
Biden's comments come 5 days after Lucy Flores, a former Nevada assemblywoman, described an incident at a 2014 campaign event where she says Biden approached her from behind, put his hands on her shoulders, smelled her hair, and kissed her head.
I really need him to acknowledge that that behavior was inappropriate.
In the days since, three more women have described similar interactions with Biden. Nobody has accused him of sexual assault.
I hear what they're saying. I understand it. And I'll be much more mindful. That's my responsibility. My responsibility, and I'll meet it.
CBS's Ed O'Keefe reporting. New York Times reporter Jody Cantor, who's written extensively on the Me Too movement, joined CBS This Morning host Gail King, Nora O'Donnell, and John Dickerson this week for an interview that turns into a candid discussion on whether the Me Too movement has gone too far.
Do these allegations, though, minimize the more serious cases of assault
and abuse?
Well, we just have to draw a distinction. I mean, a lot of these moments occurred in public. They occurred at events. They occurred in front of other people. It's a totally different scenario than somebody like Harvey Weinstein, who is accused of drawing women into secluded places so that he could take advantage of them.
You've seen where these conversations take place, where they are done well and handled intelligently, and where they are not. Is there a worse venue in which to have these kinds of sensitive conversations than a presidential campaign?
But politics is always the hardest venue. It's the most important venue because these jobs are the definition of power, but the hardest. Clinton, Clarence Thomas, Brett Kavanaugh, Donald Trump, every time we have debates over whether over these men's conduct, they're very important, but they also get mixed with everybody's political preferences and ideas about who they want and not want, who they do and don't want to have power.
Is this a conversation about age? Because there were standards from a different generation that are now under investigation. Joe Biden obviously will be one of the older candidates running. And so is this a stalking horse also in some cases, perhaps, for a conversation about rage?
I think you hear people saying that openly. I mean, some critics of Biden's behavior on this count have essentially said, this is a sign that you are a dinosaur. You've already served your time in office. I want to see somebody nominated who represents a fresher face.
Does it matter that Joe Biden has been in public life for 30 years, that he was the architect of the Violence Against Women Act? Does it matter that dozens of women who worked with him in the Obama administration for years in close settings say he never touched me or made me feel uncomfortable? None of this was sexual in any nature.
Susan Rice today even speaking about it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'd say his record on true policy issues towards women matters a great deal and is not getting enough attention, pro and con. People talk about his contribution to the criminal justice issues you're raising, and they're also very critical of his conduct in the Anita Hill case. So there are pros and cons of his record to be debated.
But the whole conversation, I have to say, Jody, makes me uncomfortable and actually makes my teeth hurt. Have we gotten to the point that we can't have any physical contact with someone that we're trying to be friendly with, that we're trying to be sympathetic with, that we're empathizing with? The fact that someone kisses you on the back of your head or rubs you on the back, shouldn't intention and motivation matter? And to your point, it was all done publicly.
Well, we are living through a period of social change on these issues, which can feel very confusing to live through.
Very confusing.
But no less an authority than Gloria Steinem had some advice in today's paper. She said the new rule is, if you want to hug somebody, especially somebody you don't know, just ask first.
Yeah, I knew a man who was just
appointed to a CEO of a major bank today, who told his wife, I'm not going to have lunch with women anymore.
Well, that's sad, and that's unfair, and that's not right. I mean, I want to know
that is the honest conversation that is happening about a backlash where men say, I'm just not even going to do it because I'm being accused of stuff that I have nothing, and so I'm just not going to even go to lunch with women anymore. Is that helpful?
No.
And also remember.
No.
Let's be honest about that. That's an honest conversation.
Exactly.
Have you heard that, Jody?
I've read a lot of articles.
I've heard it.
That doesn't mean that man is right. That doesn't mean that that man is right. But that is true, and that is happening.
You know, I think what we don't have a sense of is how widespread that fear really is and whether it's really hurting women. You hear it a lot. You don't hear it on the record.
We're not talking to enough men, because I think that fear is widespread amongst men.
Right. But is it having real consequences in the workplace? Is it a worry or is it an action? That, I think, is very hard to know.
Well, something you wouldn't do in front of your wife, in front of your daughter, in front of your sister, you wouldn't have done to them, I think, is a pretty good barometer. There's no need for people to be confused about how to act appropriately.
But Joe Biden is being accused of doing it in front of hundreds of people with cameras.
But also, we should remember politics is just weird. People kiss babies that they don't know. That's funny, true. But it's politics is also just a very weird venue. So anyway, Jody, I'm going to have to kill it there.
That
so
really does.
Thank
put
you
in
very much.
Jody's
thank
like
you.
This conversation. You guys have
Jody's
off the
like,
rails.
Thanks. Yeah. Glad I came.
That's New York Times reporter Jody Kantor writing exclusively on the Me Too movement, joining CBS This Morning host Gail King, Nora O'Donnell, and John Dickerson. This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. They'll leave the light on for you, but as CBS's Jim Taylor reports, Motel 6 was also ratting out some of its guests to immigration authorities.
Motel 6's new improved website.
Motel 6 is agreeing to pay $12 million to settle a Washington state lawsuit claiming that the national chain improperly gave the names of hotel guests to immigration officials. Thousands of names over a couple of years. That allegedly led to targeted investigations of people with Latino-sounding names. Some folks staying in Motel 6 locations were detained or even deported.
We'll leave the light on for you.
Jim Taylor, CBS News.
Sears has gotten another lease on life after being inches from going out of business. Now, as CBS's Jim Chenevie reports, the retailer is doing a bit of a facelift.
Remember the slogan, Sears has everything? Well, a little of everything might be a better way to describe the retailer's plan after bankruptcy. It's planning to open smaller stores, say 10 to 15,000 square feet. That's about a tenth of the size of a traditional Sears store. They'll focus on moneymakers for the company, like appliances, mattresses, and home services. The first three stores, called Sears Home and Life, will open Memorial Day weekend in Overland Park, Kansas, Lafayette, Louisiana, and Anchorage, Alaska. Jim Chenevie, CBS News.
And good news on the jobs front to wrap up the week, CBS News business analyst Jill Schlesinger.
The healthcare industry continues to add jobs. 49,000 in March, almost 400,000 jobs in healthcare over the past 12 months.
The unemployment rate held steady at 3.8%. Coming up, an investigation into the safety of jet bridges. This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
I'm Bill Rakoff. Thanks for joining us. Have you ever given a thought to the safety of the jet bridges that you walk through when you are boarding and deplaning at the airport? Well, a CBS News radio investigation by our own Steve Dorsey suggests that perhaps you should.
Two people were hurt last night after a frightening jet bridge collapse at LAX.
From LA,
the cause of this collapse is mechanical failure,
to Baltimore,
several people are recovering after a jet bridge collapsed at BWI Airport.
Jet bridge mishaps have led to injuries and even deaths.
The contractors were repairing a 4-foot-tall tire inside a workshop. This one was being used for a jet bridge when it exploded. One of them was instantly killed.
Now, maintenance reports obtained by CBS News Radio reveal damaged jet bridges and safety hazards at airports from coast to coast.
We're walking on the bridge, and then all of a sudden, I fell.
Wendy Murphy says she tripped and fell over a metal ring holding in place a wooden panel on a jet bridge in Fayetteville, North Carolina, injuring her shoulder.
I could see that I had tripped over something. It was like it was sticking up in the bridge.
At Salt Lake City International Airport alone, records detail slipping and tripping hazards and passengers and workers injured by a sliding door or missing flooring. Maintenance reports at other airports found cracked and falling glass, loose cables, hydraulic leaks, and broken wheels.
Jet bridges like the one I'm on at BWI Airport in Baltimore are complex structures with lots of moving parts and electrical and ventilation components. Some are 30 years old, with maintenance crews fighting issues like corroding rust and aging safety features.
And they're complicated.
Matthew Likens is an aviation maintenance consultant.
If you have issues with the electric drive motors or the hydraulic lift systems, these are safety sensitive and safety critical systems on the bridge and would require immediate repair.
Often it's up to airports to ensure the structures are safe, but at Chicago's Midway Airport, aviation attorney Patrick Murphy says it was a consortium of airlines responsible for the jet bridge where his client tripped and fell over a rusted deformed hump in 2014, breaking her arm.
That should have been inspected certainly on a monthly basis. And if it had been, that hump would have been discovered and she wouldn't have been injured.
With the country's jet bridges aging amid maintenance mistakes and accidents, sometimes air travel can be hazardous on the ground. Steve Dorsey, CBS News, Washington.
This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. Last month, Vice President Mike Pence spoke to the Trump administration's goal for a return to the moon by 2024, echoing a call made by President John F. Kennedy in a 1961 speech to Congress. His challenge set off a race to put a man on the moon before the Soviet Union. And with the 50th anniversary of the moon landing this July, historian Douglas Brinkley joined CBS This Morning host Nora O'Donnell, Gail King, and John Dickerson to discuss the backstory of the mission in his new book, American Moonshot, John F. Kennedy and the Great Space Race.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Does the administration have a shot the way John Kennedy did?
John Kennedy was a great salesperson for space. I teach at Rice University. On September 12, 1962, he gave that amazing speech. We choose to go to the moon, you know, not because it's easy, but because it's hard. And he tied why we go to the moon into science education, math education, history of exploration, Christopher Columbus, Lewis and Clark. Vice President Pence is talking Huntsville, which, while good, it didn't have that inspirational, aspirational tone. I think the Trump administration will have to sell going back to the moon a little more vigorously than they have thus far.
And let me ask you this. Kennedy also had the Cold War. And so how did that help in both in the specific space race, but more broadly? And how does the lack of that affect our politics today?
The Cold War is everything about going to the moon, because in 1957, the Soviet Union put the Sputnik satellite up. And alarm bells ran all over America. We're losing the space race. We're losing satellites. We're losing in ICBMs. And there's a missile gap. The big cheerleader of a missile gap was young John F. Kennedy, a senator. He built the missile gap and the space gap that Eisenhower was asleep at the wheel as a campaign pledge. So when he runs in 1960, he's talking about space a lot. In fact, he tells Nixon in one of the debates, "You told Khrushchev at the kitchen debate that you want America's number one in appliances. I'll take my TV in black and white, thank you. I want to be number one in rocket thrust."
So what did he see that others didn't, Doug, back then? And how big of a sell was it? And because it cost a lot of money.
It would have been $180 billion in today's dollars.
$180 billion today's dollars, a ton. What he saw, really, he hedged his bets once he became president. But then the Soviets put up Yuri Gagarin, and they put the first human in space on Kennedy's watch. Mm-hmm. But then Kennedy, on May 5th, 1961, watched Alan Shepard, the astronaut, Mercury astronaut, go up and down, TV ratings bonanza. Yeah. Kennedy noticed television was his medium, and that every one of those Mercury launches during Kennedy's presidency, whether it's Gus Grissom or John Glenn or Wally Schirra or Scott Carpenter, everybody would watch. It became must-watch TV, and Kennedy starts identifying the astronauts as my space corps, my elite group, Kennedy astronauts. And also, you know, FDR had the New Deal, had the Grand Coulee Dam and WPA bridges and the like. Eisenhower built the interstate highway system, St. Lawrence Seaway. Kennedy's infrastructure became high-tech, technology corridors. So my book talks about how the southern states started tracking all this NASA money, hundreds of millions of dollars, billions, pouring into places like San Antonio for space medicine, or Houston manned space, Huntsville, Alabama for rocketry, Brevard, North Carolina for star watching.
States that were politically important that Kennedy needed. Let's talk about today with NASA canceling an all-female spacewalk next week because they didn't have two medium-sized spacesuits for the women. Shouldn't NASA make this return to the moon, this next moonshot about having women, the first woman on the moon?
Absolutely. And back in the day, Edward R. Murrow of CBS fame was promoting having somebody who either an African-American or Latino-American, because Murrow said most of the world isn't white, and we're sending only white astronauts up. What a big thing if America could put a non-white astronaut up. They didn't listen to that. All of the Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo astronauts were white men, but they had trained 13 women known as the Mercury 13. They were trained in New Mexico by Dr. Randy Lovelace, passed every test, endurance test with flying colors, really tough, great pilots. But in the end, NASA said, no, we're not going to put a woman into space. So the Soviets beat us with the first woman in space. But we got Sally Ride. Yeah. We got Sally Ride in 1983.
And a whole new crop of girls.
Then now women galore are entering.
Well, white men, as you know, are everywhere. So it's good that they're including other people in this game.
Yes, they are including it.
Historian Douglas Brinkley talking about his book, American Moonshot, John F. Kennedy and the Great Space Race. Coming up, singer-songwriter Maren Morris and how she's using her voice to push for change in the music industry. This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
This is The Takeout with Major Garrett.
Every week, an extended conversation at a restaurant at our nation's capital with newsmakers like Democratic Senator Mark Warner.
What we want to try to do is give the American people the truth.
President's attorneys Jay Sekulow and Rudy Giuliani.
It is a no collusion, absolutely no obstruction.
Democratic presidential candidate Andrew Yang.
I think we should have a psychologist in the White House.
Politics, policy, and a side of pop culture. The Takeout with me, Major Garrett.
on the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
I'm Bill Rakoff. Millions of people have played the popular game Fortnite since its debut a year and a half ago, as players battle with guns and other weapons on a fantasy island or work together in what's called creative mode. According to a survey from Common Sense Media, 61% of U.S. teens have played the game. 24% of parents worry about the amount of time the kids are spending on it. Dr. Sue Varma is a board-certified psychiatrist and assistant professor at NYU Langone Medical Center. She tells CBS This Morning that playing games like Fortnite give kids a hit of the hormone dopamine.
There is such a flood of dopamine that's resulting. We're finding that just anticipation alone of the video games can increase your dopamine by 70% in the brain, which is the pleasure and reward system. But the problem is that these young kids, their developing brain has the foot on the gas, but it doesn't have a foot on the brake. So we don't have the same control and regulation. The kids don't know when to stop.
So how does it affect their development?
So we're finding that kids often, like, there's a craving set up where when you interrupt the kids, they get extremely irritable. And we do know that there have been some cases of violence where kids are breaking into their parents' car to try to get their devices. They're stealing credit cards. Now, that's not the norm. That's not the baseline. Most kids are able to regulate their playing, but we are finding that kids that are more vulnerable, who might be prone to depression or anxiety or have difficulty making friends, might be using this as a form of coping or avoidance.
So when does it become appropriate to let kids use their own executive decision-making skills?
Look, it really depends on the child, right? You have to know the child, do they have the ability to be able to say no? And really what it comes down to is, do they have a more compelling activity, right? Because a lot of times kids are going to say, why do I have to stop? What's more interesting than this? I don't find homework interesting. Yeah. But I think you have to give them what we call a healthy diet of other pleasurable activities. Nothing can replace the human connection. If your kids really enjoy spending time with you, with friends, reward that as behavior. Say, can we go to your favorite movie? Can we go to a play? Can we go outdoor hiking? Can we go rock climbing?
Easier said than done sometimes, and Varma admits that it's tough on parents.
Absolutely. It's very hard because, look, when you set limits and those limits are broken, there's a breach of trust in the house. It says, I thought that we were on the same page. Mm-hmm. But I'm finding that giving the kids a part, a hand in the accountability and saying, listen, it's up to you, right? You can choose this or you can choose that, but you can't have both.
But how much is too much, and is Dr. Varma seeing any negatives to playing these games?
I am. Like, there is a level of the competition, right, the violence that sometimes, we're not saying that this is what is going to lead to stuff outside, but it is wiring the brain to sort of set people up against each other and a survival mode. So if the kid, the problem is, does your child know the difference between reality and fantasy? Are they able to draw the line to talk about? Yes. And a parent really should be on the lookout for dangerous behaviors. Is your kid starting to socially withdraw? Are their grades going down? Are they not connecting to people? Is their personal hygiene going down? Are they preoccupied with thoughts of death? That's a big one. Do they talk about suicide? So many parents are afraid to ask the difficult questions because they think that they're going to plant seeds into the minds of their children. And let me tell you this, those thoughts, if they exist, have been there for years. So know the warning signs.
Dr. Sue Varma, a board-certified psychiatrist and assistant professor at NYU Langone Medical Center on CBS This Morning. This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. I'm Bill Rakoff. The Academy of Country Music Awards airs Sunday night here on CBS, and Maren Morris is nominated for Female Artist of the Year. Her new album, Girl, debuted at number one on the country Billboard charts and broke streaming records for a female country artist. The 28-year-old singer-songwriter is now using her voice to push for change in the music industry.
Won't you stop your crying? I know that you're trying.
I think that it's a really interesting time to be in music right now when all of the post-Me Too conversations happened. It makes you recognize in yourself things that you've allowed that aren't acceptable.
What you feel is natural. You don't gotta put up with this anymore.
Everything from a program director of a radio station hanging on you and being drunk and inappropriate to feeling like you have to laugh at someone's joke that isn't funny. I've learned that I don't have to do those things.
I've cursed on a Sunday. I've cheated and I've lied.
Women in country music have always been grossly underrepresented when it comes to country radio. She's kind of using every tool she has to force change around this topic and make sure it's constantly being talked about in Nashville, which is incredibly powerful.
Can I get a hallelujah? Can I get an amen?
I'm remember when we wrote the song Flavor for my record, there's a line in the bridge that says, I won't play the victim, I don't fit that mold, but shut up and sing, hell no, I won't.
I speak my peace, don't do what I'm told. Shut up and sing, well, hell no, I won't.
It just felt like an F yeah moment for me to be brave enough to say and put on a record and now sing in every live show.
Maren Morris cut common with an openly gay Americana singer, Brandi Carlile.
We got way too much in common.
Nashville is known as being a little bit more of a conservative place. Artists don't tend to tackle social issues, but it's also extremely groundbreaking and extremely inclusive.
I just think that I've somehow been lucky in the risky moves I've made in my career. And my hope for country music is that it stays true to itself, but it also doesn't get left behind.
It's really easy to look at Maren Morris and think, oh, wow, she's this overnight success, but she's been working at it hard for years, since she was a teenager in Texas, playing local bars.
Oh, my God, I tried out for every television talent show. And I remember the cattle call auditions for American Idol. You get 10 seconds in a row of four people for these, like, 25-year-old producers. They said none of us made it. And you have to do the walk of shame, like, through the tunnel of the stadium and go back to the parking lot where your mom's parked and just, like, cry on the way home.
There were probably about a million times when Maren Morris could have said, I'm sick of hearing no, and stopped pursuing her dreams, but she kept writing. And now that she has a platform, there's kind of no way of telling what she's going to do next.
I'm a 90s baby, my 80s Mercedes.
Singing is honestly my first love and always will be. I love writing songs. I love expressing my voice in that way, but there's just something so transcendent about being on stage and having a gift that it moves people.
That's Maren Morris, nominated for Female Artist of the Year in this year's Academy of Country Music Awards, airing Sunday night on CBS. And that's it for the Weekend Roundup. Thanks for listening. As always, you can find the program online at Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, and Stitcher. The CBS News Weekend Roundup is produced at the CBS News Washington Bureau. Lou Walker is our technical supervisor. Chris Buckley, the production assistant in New York. Jake Rosen is our intern. Thank you for listening and have a great week. I'm Bill Rakoff, CBS News.